Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 10. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 36. I'm going to call this chapter, Jehu Destroys the House of Omri. And of course, Omri was Ahab's father of Ahab and Jezebel fame. And we're going to see the end of that house in this chapter. Our context is this. Jehu has just finished killing the last king of Omri's house, Ahab's house, namely Joram, Ahab's son. And along with Joram being killed, this is in 841 BC, along with Joram being killed, Joram's nephew Ahaziah, who ruled for less than 1 year in southern Israel, in Judah, who was the son of the southern king Jehoram, they both got killed by Jehu. Dramatic stuff in chapter 9. That all happened in 841 BC. But we're not finished with the killing, so let's start now with 2 Kings 10, verses 1 through 3. Since Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria, Jehu wrote letters and sent them to Samaria, to the rulers of Jezreel, to the elders, and to the guardians of Ahab's sons, saying, "When this letter arrives, since your master's sons are with you, and you have chariots, horses, and a fortified city, and weaponry, select the most qualified of your master's sons, set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house." Now these sons in Samaria, 70 of them, they are descendants, because when you see sons, that means either sons of the first generation or the second or the third and so forth. It can mean descendants. Now just a little background on Ahab's family tree. His father was Omri, of course, starting the dynasty. Then Ahab himself ruled from 874 to 853. His oldest son, Ahaziah, who fell through the lattice and died, he ruled from 853 to 852. And then Joram, that's J-O-R-A-M, he ruled from 852 to this year, 841. He's just been killed in the last chapter. So Ahab had 70 descendants in Samaria. Now these people could either be descended from Joram or descended from Ahab somehow in collateral branches. Doesn't matter, they're potential heirs to the throne, and so we're going to see Jehu wiping them out. Jehu writes letters and sent them to Samaria. Samaria, of course, is the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. It's roughly in the middle of Ephraim, the tribe that's north of Benjamin. Benjamin being the tribe that's just to the north of Jerusalem. Now, there's a little bit of confusion here, because Jehu wrote letters and sent them to Samaria, to the rulers of Jezreel. What are the rulers of Jezreel doing in Samaria? Well, the Septuagint has the rulers of Samaria, not the rulers of Jezreel, so it could be just be a translation problem. Gill and Clark state that that's the case, or it could be that some rulers from Jezreel, and remember, Jezreel is the summer home, the vacation home, if you will, of the kings of Israel. It's north of Samaria in the Jezreel Valley, the Esdraelon Valley, that runs northwest to southeast from Mount Carmel to the Jordan River. Now, it could be that some of the rulers of Jezreel had actually gone down to Samaria, fled there. They might have gone down there because Jezreel had just been attacked by Jehu. Remember, Jezebel got thrown from her palace at Jezreel, and Joram, her son, had gotten thrown into the vineyard of Naboth at Jezreel. So that's where all the action was. They could have fled from that to get away from Jehu, to go to Samaria, which is fortified, to go down there to see who are we going to replace Joram with. Maybe they're down there plotting to figure out how they can overthrow Jehu after Jehu's great military victory. Now, as I said, Samaria was fortified. It was walled. In fact, Jehu tells them, "Hey, elders, your city is fortified. You've got chariots and horses and weaponry. And since it was fortified, it was able to stand a long siege," which, of course, I'm sure Jehu didn't want to be engaged in. And so he asked them, "Come on out and fight. Let's get this over with." Well, what were Jehu's motives in this challenge? As I said, he might have wanted to snuff out his opposition in one quick blow so he doesn't have to go through a siege. He probably gave him this invitation to fight to see if his opposition really wanted to fight, or maybe perhaps they would rather sue for peace. And there's always the chance when you offer a city these terms that Samaria might have wanted to surrender without a fight. Now, you could read that letter as being an objective request to surrender, but it was probably ironical. As Adam Clark says, the letter means this, as Clark puts it in King James English, "Ye have no means of defense. Israel is with me. If you yield not up yourselves and the city, I will put you all to the sword." Well, the elders of northern Israel, meeting there in Samaria, were greatly afraid. We go to 2 Kings 10, verses 4 through 8. "But they feared greatly and said, Behold, the two kings did not stand before him." The two kings being Joram of northern Israel and Ahaziah of Judah in the south. Ahaziah had gone north to see his uncle Joram because Joram had been wounded in a battle at Ramoth-Gilead. And so he had just gone up there on a family visit, if you will, not for any military reasons. But he got himself killed in the last chapter at Megiddo. So the elders are saying, "The two kings did not stand before Jehu. How can we stand?" And the one who was over the household, that would be the king's chamberlain there in Samaria, over the palace. And he who was over the city, the elders and the guardians of the children, that's the 70 sons of Joram, or Ahab, I should say, 70 sons of Ahab, 70 descendants of Ahab, they sent word to Jehu, saying, "We are your servants. All that you say to us, we will do. We will not make any man king. Do what is good in your sight." So basically, they surrendered to Jehu and said, "You be king." Ahab's dynasty is Kaputsky, verse 6. Then Jehu wrote a letter to the elders in Samaria a second time, saying, "If you are on my side and you will listen to my voice, take the heads of the men, your master's sons," that's the 70 sons of Ahab, 70 descendants of Ahab, "come to me at Jezreel tomorrow about this time." Remember, Jehu is at Jezreel because that's where he had executed Jezebel and had shot Joram in the back with an arrow. All that happened in Jezreel. Now the kings, that's Ahab's descendants, 70 persons who were with the great men of the city, the leaders of Samaria, who were rearing them. They were there with these great men of the city who were rearing the sons. When the letter came to the elders, they took the kings, that's Ahab's sons, and slaughtered them, 70 persons, and put their heads in baskets, and sent the heads to Jehu, who was at Jezreel. When the messenger came and told Jehu, saying, "They have brought the head of Ahab's descendants," Jehu said, "Put them in two heaps at the entrance of the gate until morning." Now the leaders of Samaria were actually very afraid. They say, "How can we stand?" That shows that they were basically cowards, because they were actually in a much stronger position than the two kings who had been killed. They said, "These two kings have been killed, namely Joram of the north and Ahaziah of the south, Uncle Joram and nephew Ahaziah, they've been killed. So since they've been killed, how can we withstand Jehu?" But the difference is that those two kings were killed in open chariots. They weren't hiding behind the walls of a fortified city. We read in 2 Kings 10:2, which is where we are now, "When this letter comes to you," the letter from Jehu, "since your master's sons are with you, as well as the chariots and horses and a fortified city and weapons." In other words, you guys are armed to the hilt. Didn't matter. They were still cowards. They wouldn't fight. So they kill the 70 descendants of Ahab. They put them in a basket, the heads, carry them up, or send them up to Jezreel, and Jezreel arranges them at the entrance of the gate. This was at nighttime or in the evening, so in the morning time, people would get up, look at the entrance of Jezreel. It might be the palace at Jezreel, the city, I'm not sure which, but wherever. They would look at these heaps of heads and say, "Oh my goodness, there has been regime change." Of course, this was for show, to intimidate possible opponents to that regime change. Now, Adam Clark says that killing these 70 people and doing that, the officials of Israel committed horrid murders, quote unquote. And of course, the purpose was to shock Israel into submission and to let Israel know that the disaster was due to divine judgment. This idea of piling skulls up, I think the Persians did it. I think they did it at Thermopylae when they actually won that famous battle where the 300 Spartans held out. I think, if I remember correctly, the Persians had piled up a bunch of Greek heads. But it happens all the time. It happens in medieval history all the time, too. 2 Kings 10, 9 through 11. "Now in the morning he," that's Jehu, "went out and said to all the people, You are innocent. Behold. Now, this, of course, is in Jezreel, now not in Samaria. You are innocent. Behold, I conspired against my master Joram, and killed him. But who killed all these people? All these people, these 70 heads here, who took care of them? Well, let's stop there. Jehu is a horrible murderer, but he's managed to make himself look relatively innocent. He says, hey, yeah, well, that's true. I did kill Joram, but hey, I didn't kill 70 descendants of Ahab. So he's passing the blame off on the officials of Israel who killed those 70 descendants of Ahab. He didn't bother to tell the people that he was the one that gave the orders, that Jehu was the one who gave the orders to the officials of Israel to kill the descendants of Ahab. He conveniently forgot to mention that. He goes on in verse 10. Jehu says, know then, as he speaks to the people, know then that there shall fall to the earth nothing of the word of the Lord. The word of the Lord that Jehu is referring to is the word that Elijah had given in Naboth's vineyard to Ahab, 1 Kings 21, verse 21. Behold, I, Yahweh says, will bring evil upon you, Ahab, and will utterly sweep you away, and will cut off from Ahab every male, both bond and free, in Israel. And so Jehu is saying, I'm just fulfilling Elijah's prophecy. Don't get upset with me just because I'm a little bloody. 1 Kings 21, 29. Yahweh says, do you see how Ahab has humbled himself before me? That's when God gave him this horrible prophecy about all his descendants being killed. Ahab humbled himself, went around in sackcloth. And so God says in verse 29, 1 Kings 21, because Ahab has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but I will bring the evil upon his house in his son's days. And his son there is not his direct descendant, his actual son, Joram. And so Jehu knows these prophecies, and he's quoting them. He's saying, see there, I'm just doing what Elijah said that God is saying, Yahweh is saying, so don't blame me. Jehu's saying all this to cover up his actions, first of all, for killing the 70 descendants of Ahab. But he's not finished, because in this chapter, in verse 19, we will see Jehu killing all the prophets of Baal and his worshipers in the temple of Baal. So Jehu is a bloody man, but he's speaking very piously here. Verse 11, so Jehu killed all who remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men, and his acquaintances, and his priests, until he left him without a survivor. So not only did Jehu kill the descendants of Ahab, some of whom might have been descendants of Joram, actually, but the male relatives in the house of Ahab, he killed those, but also all of his great men. That's his government officials and his acquaintances. That's just people who knew him. And his priests, those are the Baal priests, until he left Ahab without a survivor. Ahab, of course, is already dead, but it means there's nobody in the house of Ahab who lives. Now, all of this happened in Jezreel. But Jehu is still not finished. He's got some more blood to shed because he's got to go back down south to Samaria and kill people there also. We'll see that in just a minute. Now, it's ironic that the great men in verse 11 who were killed in Jezreel, they may have been some of those who had cut off the 70 heads in Samaria and carried the heads up in baskets to Jezreel. If that's the case, then that means that Jehu has killed those who had just obeyed his orders. So a lot of good it did for those elders to lop off the heads of 70 descendants of Ahab. They got killed anyway, even though they did Jehu's bidding. Now, as I said, we've still got some more killing to do down at verse 17. He'll go down to Samaria and kill all who remain to Ahab, but he's taking care of Jezreel now in verse 11. So we now go to 2 Kings 10, verses 12 through 14. Then Jehu arose and departed and went to Samaria. On the way, while he was at Beth-Eked of the shepherds, Jehu met the relatives of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and said, who are you? Now remember, Ahaziah, king of Judah, the one-year wonder, ruled in 841. He was killed by the troops of Jehu and died in Megiddo in the last chapter. And it's a question of whether these relatives of Ahaziah who are coming up to see him, remember they're coming to see him because Ahaziah had gone to see Joram, Ahaziah, nephew Joram, king of the north, the uncle, Ahaziah, had gone up to Joram to comfort him because he was wounded, because Joram was wounded at a battle in Ramoth-Gilead. So there's a question of whether these relatives knew that Ahaziah was dead already or they did not know. We'll talk about that in a minute. But Jehu meets them And they answered and said, "We are the relatives of Ahaziah, and we have come down to greet the sons of the king and the sons of the queen mother." We've come down from Samaria to greet the sons of the king and the sons of the queen mother. Jehu said, "Take them alive." So they took them alive. The soldiers of Jehu took these relatives of Ahaziah alive and killed them at the pit of Beth-Eked, 42 men, and he left none of them. Now, this place is somewhere between Jezreel and Samaria, Beth-Eked of the shepherds. That name means, quote, the shearing house of the shepherds. It was a country village somewhere between Jezreel and Samaria. It was probably where the shepherds met for the annual sheep shearing, and that's why they call it Beth-Eked of the shepherds. Now, who are these relatives of Ahaziah of Judah who are marching north to Jezreel, 42 of them? Well, they're most probably the nephews of Ahaziah, not Ahaziah's brothers. As the pulpit commentator says, and as Clark says also, these are the brothers of Ahaziah had been killed by marauding Arabs. As the pulpit commentary points out, we look at 2 Chronicles 21:17, where we see this. So they, that's the Arabs, went to war, the Arabs that lived near Cush. The Arabs went to war against Judah and invaded it. They carried off all the possessions found in the king's palace and also his sons and wives. Not a son was left to him except his youngest son. And so these relatives who are going up to see Ahaziah, they must be the sons of the brothers of Ahaziah. Why do I say that? Because all the brothers of Ahaziah had been executed by marauding Arabs, as I said. Ahaziah's father was Jehoram. He ruled from 848 to 841, and Jehoram had a bunch of sons. The only son that survived the Arab invasion was Ahaziah, the youngest son, who was king in 841. He was the one that was killed by Joram of the North and died in Megiddo in the last chapter, chapter 9. So let's read in 2 Chronicles 21:17. So they, these marauding Arabs, went to war against Judah and invaded it. They carried off all the possessions found in Jehoram's palace and also Jehoram's sons and wives. Not a son was left to Jehoram except Ahaziah, his youngest son. So if Ahaziah doesn't have any brothers, these relatives, these 42 relatives of Ahaziah, must have been the sons of those slain brothers. Brothers slain by the Arabs. We know that because in 2 Chronicles 22:8 we read this. So when Jehu executed judgment on the house of Ahab, he found the rulers of Judah and the sons of Ahaziah's brothers who were serving Ahaziah, and he killed them. We're going to see this in just a minute. But Chronicles calls these relatives the sons of Ahaziah's brothers. So these are nephews. So we're going to call these the 42 nephews. Now, there's another possibility. I don't think it's very likely that these relatives were half-brothers of Ahaziah. In other words, Jehoram and Athaliah, Ahaziah's parents, they had Ahaziah, but Jehoram might have married some concubines and had kids not by Athaliah, but by concubines. And so these relatives would be half-brothers of Ahaziah, but I don't think so. Half-brothers of Ahaziah, are they really going to have a claim to the throne born of concubines? Well, but Jehu's not taking any chances, so they could be. He could have killed all them too. But let's just take these as the 42 nephews of Ahaziah. They've gone up to Beth-Eked of the shepherds, and they get themselves killed by Jehu. Before they're killed, they tell Jehu, they say, "We've come to greet the sons of the king." Well, which king are we talking about, Joram or Ahab? If they're coming to see the sons of Joram, and Ellicott takes the king there to be Joram, so does Colin Delitzsch, so does Cambridge. So if they're going to see the sons of Joram, they're going to see 70 severed heads piled up in heaps by gate. They don't know that, of course, at least, well, they may or may not know that, I don't know, but that's what they tell Jehu. Optionally, now they could be, remember those 70 sons were not, actually they were not the sons of Joram, they were the sons or descendants of Ahab, so it could be they're going to greet the sons of King Ahab, who of course is already dead. John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown mentioned that possibility. Well, I think that most of the commentators say the king here is Joram, so we have come down to greet the sons of King Joram and the sons of the queen mother. Now, almost everybody says the queen mother is Jezebel. So basically what these 42 nephews are saying, nephews of Ahaziah, are saying, we have come to greet the descendants of either Ahab or Joram, and it doesn't really matter. The point is they're coming up to see people in the house of Ahab. They are potential heirs to continue Ahab's line in the dynasty of Omri, and so Jehu doesn't like that, so he kills them. Now, I said the scholars are not certain as to the reason why these 42 nephews are headed north to see Ahaziah. There's two options. They could have been heading north to revenge the death of Joram, or more particularly, the death of Ahaziah, who died at Megiddo in the last chapter. Pulpit commentator believes that. Or it could have been they were up there just on a pleasure visit. They're just going up there to see Ahaziah, who they don't know is dead yet, according to that theory. Well, and Ellicott believes that. I believe that the pulpit commentator has the equities in favor of their position. Let me read you why they think that the purpose of the northward trip of the 42 nephews was to revenge Joram and Ahaziah's death. Quote, 42 princes with their retinues do not, under ordinary circumstances, start off on a sudden with one capital on a complimentary visit to their cousins at another. Perhaps Ewald is right in surmising that at the first report of disturbances in the kingdom of the 10 tribes, they had been sent off by Athalia, that's their grandmother, to render any assistance that they could to the house of Ahab in his troubles. In this case, their answer must be regarded as insincere. In other words, they're lying. Oh, we're going up to see our uncle Ahaziah. We're not going up there to start a revolution or to take control of the throne. Because of all the death that you've done to the house of Ahab? Oh, no, we're just going up there, minding our own business. Pulpit commentary continues, falling in with an armed force stronger than their own, they pretended ignorance of the revolution that had taken place and sought to pass off their hostile purpose under the pretense of a visit of compliment. But the pretense did not deceive Jehu. That's what I think is happening. They're going up there with blood on their minds. Benson and Ellicott, on the other hand, two respectable commentators, say that no, they're just going up there to see Ahaziah on a pleasure visit. Quote, the news of the taking of Ramoth, that's the battle that happened that got Joram shot and wounded him such that he retreated to Jezreel to recover himself. And of course, Israel's troops held the city. The news of the taking of Ramoth and of Joram's convalescence may have reached Jerusalem and induced these princes to make a visit of pleasure to the court of Jezreel, not suspecting the events which had meanwhile happened with the headlong rapidity characteristic of Jehu's action. In other words, Benson and Ellicott don't think these 42 nephews of Ahaziah knew what had happened. They thought Ahaziah was still alive. We go down to 2 Kings 10, verses 15 through 17. Now when he, that's Jehu, had departed from there, he met Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, coming to meet him. And Jehu greeted Jehonadab and said to him, is your heart right as my heart is with your heart? And Jehonadab answered, it is. Jehu said, if it is, give me your hand. And Jehonadab gave Jehu Jehonadab's hand. And Jehu took Jehonadab up to him into the chariot. Jehu said, come with me and see my zeal for the Lord. So Jehu made Jehonadab ride in Jehu's chariot. When Jehu came to Samaria, he killed all who remained to Ahab in Samaria until he had destroyed them, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke to Elijah. All right, Jehu, having killed the 42 nephews of Ahaziah of Judah, continues southward from Beth-Eked of the shepherds, and he's on his way to Samaria. He meets this guy named Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. Now, this guy, Jehonadab, was a Kenite. He's one of the descendants of Jethro, who was the father-in-law of Moses. The Kenites were down there at Mount Sinai in the Sinai Peninsula and across the Gulf of Aqaba over there in present-day Jordan, over there in the desert, and they were scattered all the way throughout Israel. They show up a lot in Israelite history. This particular Jehonadab was a wise and good man, as appears by the laws and rules he gave his posterity. So let's see how Jeremiah, writing a couple of hundred years later, describes Jehonadab. Jeremiah 35, 6 through 10. But they said, we will not drink wine for Jehonadab. Jehonadab is the same thing as Jehonadab. Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, our father commanded us, saying, you shall not drink wine, you or your sons, forever. You shall not build a house, and you shall not sow seed, and you shall not plant a vineyard or own one, but in tents you shall dwell all your days, that you may live many days in the land where you sojourn. We have obeyed the voice of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, in all that he commanded us, not to drink wine all our days, we, our wives, our sons, or our daughters, nor to build ourselves houses to dwell in, and we do not have vineyard or field or seed. We have only dwelt in tents and have obeyed and have done according to all that Jonadab, our father, commanded us. So this man was a world-class teetotaler, and he also didn't like to stay put. He liked to travel around and live in tents. Now, I don't know why that makes one wise and holy and just and good, but the people thought so. In the times of Jeremiah, 200 years or so later, they thought so. And apparently, they thought so in Jehu's time, because he wants Jehonadab to get into his chariot and ride with him to Samaria to give him some cred, to let there be a halo effect with Jehonadab so that some of Jehonadab's virtue and goodness might rub off on the bloody Jehu. Now, in verse 15, it says he greeted him. That's probably Jehu greeted Jehonadab. And then Jehu says to Jehonadab, give me your hand. Well, that might be simply Jehu helping Jehonadab into the chariot, which I believe it was. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest that maybe that Jehu is asking for a covenant here. Make a league with me, Jehonadab. I'm going to Samaria. If you will come with me to Samaria, we'll make a deal. Well, I think that's reading too much into it, my humble opinion. Now, Jehu in verse 16 tells Jehonadab, come with me, Jehonadab, and see my zeal for Yahweh. Well, has Jehu become a convert? John Gill doesn't say so, doesn't think so. He says, quote, this seems to savor very much of vainglory, hypocrisy, and a pharisaical spirit. And this is what Clark says, O thou ostentatious and murderous hypocrite, thou have zeal for Yahweh and his pure religion? Witness thy calves at Dan and Bethel, and the general profligacy of thy conduct. Clark, when he gets upset, he goes into King James English. So I suspect that Jehu's being a little bit of a hypocrite trying to get Jonadab as a political help. John Gill says, quote, the company of such a man, so famous for wisdom and goodness, Jehu knew would give him much countenance among the people and sanction to what he did, namely killing everybody in sight. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown agrees with that. Now, that makes sense to me. Now in verse 17, Jehu gets to Samaria, and Jonadab gets to watch Jehu kill all who remained to Ahab in Samaria. Now what does that all encompass? Well, all of Ahab's family, if there's any left, the 70 sons have already been killed, but you know, I'm sure there's women folk around. He killed all the civil officials, he killed all the religious officials. When he was up in Jezreel, he just killed the acquaintances of Ahab. I mean, he killed everybody. Whole lot of killing going on. Now all this killing fulfilled the word of the Lord which God had spoken to Elijah. That was in 1 Kings 21, verse 21. This is Elijah speaking to Ahab in Naboth's vineyard. And Elijah is quoting the words of Yahweh. Behold, I, Yahweh, will bring evil upon you, Ahab, and will utterly sweep you away, and will cut off from Ahab every male, both bond and free, in Israel. We go down to 2 Kings 10, verses 18 through 24. Then Jehu gathered all the people and said to them, Ahab served Baal a little, Jehu will serve him much. Now that's an ironic statement considering he's just about to kill all the Baal priests, but that's what he said. Verse 19, now summon all the prophets of Baal. Jehu continues talking to the people. Summon all the prophets of Baal, all his worshippers and all his priests, to let no one be missing, for I have a great sacrifice for Baal. Whoever is missing shall not live. But Jehu did it in cunning, so that he might destroy the worshippers of Baal. And Jehu said, sanctify a solemn assembly for Baal. And they proclaimed it. Then Jehu sent throughout Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came, so that there was not a man left who did not come. And when they went into the house of Baal was filled from one end to the other. He said to the one who was in charge of the wardrobe, bring out the garments for all the worshippers of Baal. So the keeper of the wardrobe brought out garments for the worshippers of Baal. Jehu went into the house of Baal with Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. And he said to the worshippers of Baal, "Search and see that there is here with you none of the servants of Yahweh, but only the worshippers of Baal." Then they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings. Now Jehu had stationed for himself 80 men outside. And he said, "The one who permits any of the men whom I bring into your hands to escape shall give up his life in exchange." Now at verse 18, Jehu said, "Some people have served Baal a little bit. Jehu will serve him much." He could have been being a little sarcastic there, a little ironic, because he knew he was going to serve Baal much by killing all of Baal's priests. So he might have been being sarcastic. But basically the reason he spoke was to deceive the priests of Baal so that they would show up for what they thought was going to be a great big pagan shindig, which was going to end up in mass murder. Now, this deception of the priest of Baal has given rise to some controversy. There are two opinions about it. Some people say that the deception was not justified. That would be John Gill and Adam Clark. On the other hand, there are other commentators who say that the killing of the priest was justified. That's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. So let's give you what they say, what these commentators say about this deception. Here's what Clark says. "For barbarity and hypocrisy, Jehu has few parallels, and the cowardliness and baseness of the nobles of Samaria have seldom been equaled." That's the killing of the 70 descendants. "Ahab's bloody house must be cut off, but did God ever design that it should be done by these means?" Well, Adam, maybe he did. But see, Adam Clark is an Armenian. He can't imagine a wrathful God doing justice on people. It's hard for him as an Armenian to see that. So he asked this question like, "Well, of course God wouldn't do that." Well, oh, yes, he would. "The men were, no doubt, profligate and wicked," the prophets of Baal that are about to be killed, "and God permitted their iniquity to manifest itself in this way, and thus the purpose of God, that Ahab's house should no more reign, was completely accomplished. And by this conduct, Jehu is said to have executed what is right in God's eyes." We'll see that in verse 30 at the end of this chapter. "The cutting off of Ahab's family was decreed by the divine justice. The means by which it was done, or at least the manner of doing, were not entirely of his appointing. Yet the commission given him by the young prophet was very extensive." This unnamed prophet who said, "Go get them," 2 Kings 9:7. Which was last chapter. "Yet still many things seem to be attributed to God as the agent which he does not execute but only permits to be done." Again, the Armenians' perpetual efforts to defend God's justice. Well, I don't have any trouble with what happened to the priest of Baal. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown doesn't either. This is my argument. This is not from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, but this is my first argument against Clark, in which I claim that Jehu was perfectly justified in what he did. Elijah the prophet killed a bunch of prophets of Baal. 1 Kings 18:40, "Then Elijah ordered them, 'Seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let even one of them escape.' So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the Wadi Kishon," that's the Kishon Brook, Kishon River, "and slaughtered them there." Well, if Elijah killed a bunch of prophets of Baal, well, it doesn't say that God justified that. Maybe Elijah sinned. Yeah, well, maybe, but I don't think so. This is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about this deception of the prophets of Baal. Quote, "A deep-laid plot which he had resolved upon for their extinction." That's Jehu's plot. "A measure in perfect harmony with the Mosaic law and worthy of a constitutional king of Israel. It was done, however, not from religious but purely political motives, because Jehu believed that the existence and interest of the Baalites were inseparably bound up with the dynasty of Ahab, and because he hoped by their extermination he would secure the attachment of the far larger and more influential party who worshipped God in Israel." Okay, sure, his motives were not good. He just had political motives. Reminds me of Donald Trump. Did a lot of things to try to protect Christians, but what were his motives? And nobody really knows, do they? "Jehonadab's concurrence must have been given in the belief of his being actuated solely by the highest principles of piety and zeal." Wow, what a big difference in opinion between Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, and Adam Clark. Well, I've given you my opinion. I think it was perfectly justifiable what Jehu did. I don't have any sympathy for the prophets of Baal. So, verse 21, "Jehu sent throughout Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came." Now, there was no reason for these Baal worshippers to suspect Jehu. Jehu himself might have been a worshipper of Baal in the times of Joram, the recently deceased king in 841 BC. But Adam Gill objects, but what about what Jehu had done to Baal's priest? 2 Kings 10:17, when Jehu came to Samaria, the city he is in now, getting ready to have this big sacrifice to Baal, he had just struck down all who remained of the house of Samaria, and we can assume that all would include the priest of Baal. Well, you could push back against that and say, well, yeah, but sure, he killed all of those people, but he was killing them not because they were priests of Baal, but because they were serving Ahab's family. So that might allay their suspicions. And anyway, they didn't have any choice, because if they didn't go to the great Baal sacrifice, Jehu was going to kill them. So they had no choice. So either they went not suspecting Jehu, or maybe some of them went suspecting Jehu, but it didn't make any difference. They had to go. Now in verse 21, the house of Baal, the temple of Baal, was filled from one end to the other. Some have raised a question, how could all the priests of Baal in Israel fit in one temple? The worshippers might have been in the courtyard, but it does say the temple was filled from one end to the other. Let's say that's the temple of priest, Baal priest. Well, remember, the priest of Baal, the tribe of the priest of Baal, had been culled somewhat. Remember Elijah, I just told you about how he had taken the priest of Baal by the Kishon River after the big contest on Mount Carmel and killed them. So, scratch a few priests there of Baal. Elisha had been preaching against the priest of Baal for a long time. Maybe some of the priests of Baal had quit operating. The ministry of the school of the prophets might have done the same thing. And Joram himself had put away an image of Baal. 2 Kings 3:2, Joram did what was evil in the Lord's sight, but not like his father and mother, for he removed the sacred pillar of Baal his father had made. So Joram was not exactly a Baal worshiper like Ahab was. And so the priest of Baal had fallen on hard times, nothing as bad as what's about to happen to them now, but that would explain how they could all fit into the temple of Baal. Now in verse 22, Jehu asked the person in charge of the garments to be worn in the worship of Baal. He says, bring out these garments and let the worshippers of Baal wear them. Why? Why is that even mentioned, and why was it done? Well, it could have been to make the service more solemn. They're dressed up in official religious garb, but I think the real reason was to keep the Baal worshippers distinct from the worshippers of the Lord, just in case any of them happen to be down there checking the situation out. We want to make sure we kill the right people. We don't want to kill the worshippers of Yahweh. Now, this house of Baal that was filled up with Baal priests, Ahab had built it in Samaria. We see that in 1 Kings 16:32. So Ahab erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. So, matter of historical note, Ahab had built this temple. Now, in verse 23, the text states that Jehu went into the house of Baal with Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. What was Jehonadab doing there? He had to have known of Jehu's plan to kill all the Baal worshippers, otherwise he never would have gone into the idolatrous temple. Well, I suppose he was there because that's what he wanted to happen. He wanted to see Baal wiped out in northern Israel. So Jehu says to the worshippers of Baal, see that there are none of the servants of Yahweh here. Now, of course, he could have said that, or they could have taken it to mean, well, we got to get rid of those nasty golden calf Yahweh worshippers out of here because this is just a worship for Baal, so let's get rid of them. We've got to keep this Baal worship pure. That's what he said. But his real reason was he didn't want them to get killed in the upcoming massacre. So the worshippers of Baal thought that the reason that they were spoken to thusly was to keep the Baal worship pure, but the real reason is because Jehu did not want to kill the followers of the golden calves or the followers of Yahweh. Either one. He needs their political support. It's not because he loves Yahweh. He puts 80 men outside the temple of Baal to keep anybody from escaping when the massacre starts. Now, some people have objected that 80 soldiers is not enough. I think that's plenty. You surround a temple. The soldiers are armed. The worshipers in the temple are not armed, and they were unsuspecting as to what was about to happen to them, so that's not a problem at all. We go now to 2 Kings chapter 10, verses 25 through 29. Then it came about, as soon as Jehu had finished offering the burnt offering, that Jehu said to the guard and to the royal officers, go in, kill them, let none come out. and they killed them with the edge of the sword, the royal officers did, and the guard and the royal officers threw them out and went to the inner room of the house of Baal. They brought out the sacred pillars of the house of Baal and burned them. They also broke down the sacred pillar of Baal and broke down the house of Baal and made it a latrine to this day. Thus Jehu eradicated Baal out of Israel. However, as far the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin, from these Jehu did not depart, even the golden calves that were at Bethel and that were at Dan. Now we have a little problem here in verse 25. There were all officers who went in to kill everybody in the temple. They threw them out. In other words, threw the corpses out. Well, why? The whole place is going to be burnt down anyway, or at least it was going to be destroyed so it could become a latrine. So why throw the bodies out? It's a perfect way to defile a temple is to leave the bodies in the temple as you make the latrine or as you burn the place down. Well, there's a couple of ways to answer that. John Gill and Matthew Poole say that the translation should be they flung themselves out of the house. In other words, they exited the house themselves in a hurry. Why? Well, in order to burn the place down or for what other reason, I don't know. The Cambridge and the Pulpit Commentator have, I think, a better answer to this because none of the translations take it that way, that they flung themselves out of the house, that they threw the bodies out of the house. They didn't throw their own bodies out of the temple. They threw the dead bodies out of the temple. Well, the Cambridge and Pulpit Commentator say that these royal officers threw aside the dead so they could get to the center of the temple, where probably the more important sacrificing priest would be. And I think that makes an awful lot of sense. So the officers threw the corpses out, went to the inner room. I guess that's the naos, the holy of holies of Baal, the unholy of unholies. And from there, they brought out sacred pillars and the sacred pillar of Baal. Sacred pillars were probably lesser images, the images of other deities besides Baal, used as decoration. Then they pulled out the sacred pillar, the pillar that's devoted to Baal. Baal, if I remember, is a sun god, so that pillar could have been devoted to Saturn, perhaps, or to the sun itself, or maybe to the planet. I don't know. The idolatry of these ancient nations, Near Eastern Asian nations, I am becoming more and more uninterested in. It's just that it was some kind of pagan pillar, and it was torn down. Thus Jehu, verse 28, eradicated Baal out of Israel. That sounds like it means not just out of Samaria, but out of all the cities of northern Israel. Bye-bye, Baal. However, here's the bad news. Verse 29 is for the sins of Jeroboam. That's the golden calves. Whenever you see sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that's the golden calves. Jehu did not depart from that. Those golden calves that were Bethel in the south and Dan in the north. Now, Jehu apparently did not comprehend that his golden calf idolatry was a sin. He's probably thinking, well, I got rid of Baal, so we're still worshiping Yahweh, so we're in good shape. No, he wasn't. Well, how do we know that he is still compromised? Well, in 2 Kings 10:23, he calls the worshipers of the golden calves servants of the Lord. 2 Kings 10:23, Jehu went into the house of Baal with Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, and he said to the worshipers of Baal, search out and see that there is here with you none of the servants of the Lord, servants of Yahweh, but only the worshipers of Baal. So he distinguished between the worshipers of Yahweh and the worshipers of Baal. But more important for my point here is he calls the people who are worshiping golden calves, because I'm sure a lot of these Yahweh worshipers were golden calf worshipers there because they're in Samaria. He calls them servants of Yahweh. He didn't distinguish between the servants of Yahweh who didn't worship golden calves and the servants of Yahweh who did worship golden calves. And another piece of evidence that shows that he was a compromised son of a gun is what we read in 2 Kings 25. We read there that Jehu had actually offered a burnt offering to Baal. 2 Kings 10:25, when he finished offering the burnt offering, Jehu said to the guards and officers, go in and kill them. So basically, what Jehu is doing here, this is not really a religious reformation. It was nice. God got his purposes done. But he kept the golden calves for political reasons. He didn't keep them because he wanted the people to worship Yahweh, although in an improper form. But he kept those golden calves because he didn't want his northern Israelites traveling down to Jerusalem to do legal worship because that would weaken his hold on the northern kingdom. GotQuestions.org says that because Jehu destroyed Baal worship, Jehu was a better bad king. He was a quote-unquote bad king, because all the northern Israelites were bad kings, but he was, of all the bad kings, he was better than his father Ahab, because Ahab worshiped Baal and Jehu didn't. And that's only external. Internally, Jehu, I'm sure, did not know who Yahweh was any more than Vladimir Putin knows who Yahweh was or who Yahweh is. We go now to 2 Kings 10, verses 30 through 31. The Lord said to Jehu, "Because you have done well in executing what is right in my eyes and have done to the house of Ahab according to all that was in my heart, your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel." But Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel sin. Now, how did God say this to Jehu? Probably through an unnamed prophet, as John Gill says. Jehu's sons, his dynasty, will last four generations after him for a total of five generations. Let's list them. Jehu reigned 841 to 814, first generation. Second generation, Jehoahaz, 814 to 798. Third generation, Jehoash, 798 to 782. Fourth generation, Jeroboam II, 782 to 753. Fifth generation, Zechariah, 753 to 752. Now, once we get to the end of that fifth generation, the end of the four generations after Jehu, we see that the author of 2 Kings points out that this prophecy of this unnamed prophet to Jehu was fulfilled perfectly. 2 Kings 15:12, "The word of the Lord that he spoke to Jehu was, 'Four generations of your sons will sit on the throne of Israel.' And it was so." And so the writer says, see there, the prophet was right. It was so. And he waves goodbye to this last king of Jehu's dynasty, Zechariah. Now, as the pulpit commentator says, Jehu's dynasty held the throne for five generations, which was over 100 years. No other northern Israel dynasty held the throne as much as 50 years, but Jehu lasted over 100 years. So this guy is the longest reigning, or his dynasty is the longest reigning dynasty in northern Israel's history. So we go now to 2 Kings 10, verses 32 through 36, and we will finish this audio. "In those days, the Lord began to cut off portions from Israel, and Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel." Hazael, of course, is the king of Syria, Aram, and Hazael ruled from 841 to 801. He started his rule at the same time that Jehu did, 841. So Hazael defeated the Israelites throughout the territory of Israel, from the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, the Gadites and the Reubenites and the Manassites, from Aroer, which is by the valley of the Arnon, even Gilead and Bashan. Now, I have gone over this geography so many times that it's in my head pretty good. I'm sure it's not in yours. Well, let me briefly talk about it. On the east of the Jordan River, the Transjordan area, that area in general is called Gilead, at least down until you get down to the Dead Sea. Now, the three tribes that were over there, half Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben, as you go from north to south, it runs like this, Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben. If you look at the pagan territory to the west of the Dead Sea, that's Moab, splitting Moab with a river that runs from east to west, runs into the Dead Sea, and if you keep going across the Dead Sea, you'll hit En Gedi, the famous place of the palms. That's the Arnon River. Right north of the Arnon River is Aroer, which, if I remember correctly, is the capital of Moab. That's mentioned here. So that's at the very southern end of Israel's territory, the southern end of Reuben. You go north, you get to the north of the Dead Sea, you're still on the east side of the Dead Sea in Reuben, and you get to Heshbon, which is a city right there at the north, and then that's when Reuben takes over, and that's basically where the Jordan River is, and you go north up to the Jabbok River. That's basically Gad. So after the Jabbok River, you go north of the Jabbok River, you're still east of the Jordan. That is basically half Manasseh, and you keep going up past the Sea of Galilee up until the southern border of Syria, and that is the northern border of half Manasseh. Now, Gilead is that territory to the east of the Jordan. Bashan is once you get east of the Sea of Galilee, and north on up to Syria, that's Bashan. That's the old names from Bashan. That's where Moses took over. So that's basically the Transjordan area. Haziel, since he's from Syria, he's from up there to the northeast of Israel. He's picking them off, picking the Israelites off. So it shows that Jehu is starting to not prosper because of their golden calf idolatry. Verse 34, now the rest of the acts of Jehu and all that he did and all his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And that's not the canonical book of Chronicles. That's one of the royal annals that were kept somewhere and lost to history now, and which, of course, were probably used by probably Jeremiah, who probably wrote these books of Kings. And Jehu, he ruled from 841 to 814. So in 814, he slept with his fathers, and they buried him in Samaria, in the capital. And Jehoahaz, that's the king who ruled from 814 to 798, and Jehoahaz, his son, became king in his place. Now, the time which Jehu reigned over Israel and Samaria was 28 years. So even though Jehu was a great military leader, we see that he lost territory through his reign. He did reign for 28 years, which was longer than any other king in Israel, northern Israel. Now, all this geography that I went over very quickly, I didn't mention the meaning of the Hebrew names here, so let's do that. Gilead, to the east of the Jordan River, means Hill of Testimony. Aroer, the capital of Moab, down there right north of the Arnon River, in the south of the tribe of Reuben, is Aroer, means ruins, which I think is a great name for a city, isn't it? Ruins. And then the Arnon River, which Aroer was to the north of, means swift. And, of course, that's the southern boundary of Reuben, the territory of Israel beyond the Jordan River. So Jehu lives for 28 years. Adam Clark says this, quote, "We have no chronicles in which there is anything farther spoken of this bad man. His reign was long, 28 years, and yet we know nothing of it but the commencement." And so we close the book on Jehu. Next chapter, chapter 11, which I hope you stay tuned for. In that chapter, we will see the reigns of Athaliah, who's going to take over for her son, dead son, Ahaziah. Athaliah, the wicked queen, the sister of Joram, the defeated dead Joram, who got shot by Jehu here in 841 BC. Joram, of course, was the second son of Ahab and Jezebel. So this Athaliah had married Jehoram in the south, and she had the son, Ahaziah, who's killed, and so now she's going to take over the throne. And she is one bad woman, takes after Jezebel. And then, of course, we'll look at Joash of Judah in the next chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.